have the second part of His Grace Abhiram Prabhu's presentation. And this is, well, you see this, you see what it says there in New York Farm. We're connecting the Harinam Ashram to farming and such things. So please welcome back His Grace Abhiram Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, thank you very much. Again, I pray that I may slightly advance the cause of Srila Prabhupada in bringing his mercy to the entire world. And this one very important aspect yet to be manifested, the Varnashram. Today, I'm going to talk about a concept. It's a concept plan for establishing a Varnashram project based on the best I can understand to date. I'll elaborate a little more of my intention here. Just ready to go?
I just want to plug in the power in case it goes off.
I can hit one of these buttons. Which one? The down? Mm-hmm. It's not doing anything. Didn't act. Just a brief review of one key slide from yesterday's presentation. My apologies, I rushed through a bit. I had just far too much material, and I really should have just stopped halfway rather than try to rush to the end. But primary background, as I mentioned, I had a very personal interaction with Srila Prabhupada on the subject of Varnashram. And for me, it's both a mission and philosophically supported, but also a very personal desire in my heart to bring Srila Prabhupada something of value. So having been instructed in 1974 initially to make Vaikuntha world, that instruction continued to haunt me through the years, and finally in 1977, when I was had the opportunity to be with him when he was talking about the establishment of Varnashram as one of his final concerns, his lamentation as he described it, I asked him, "What would you do? What would you do?" For me, I'm a practical person. As you probably noted, my philosophical skills are nil, and I tend to work in the mode of passion. I have, however, been endorsed by Srila Prabhupada to continue in that mode of passion, even though I asked him for sannyas, actually, in 1975, and he laughed at me. And he said, "No. Before you, who could do?" He said, "This is required, just like Arjuna." So I thought, like Arjuna, what does that mean? So here, I asked him, "What will you do? For me, as a practical person, this is everything. How do you start? What's your trajectory into a subject? Because that determines so many things, how you begin. When you start an enterprise, if there isn't the correct entry point, then you're going to suffer a lot of setbacks. And those setbacks alone could, with the combination of limitations of time, defeat your efforts." So it's very important that there's a pace, that things actually happen. And that depends a great deal on how you begin. Therefore, what will you do? Srila Prabhupada gave these three keys. "I will go to Gita Nagari, I will sit down, and I will teach you how to live off the land." I see three actions here. Well, four in the sense of going to Gita Nagari, going to a farm. But three direct actions once he arrived. Sitting down. And I think I mentioned this yesterday. I've pondered these three points for me. And I as Prabhupada's servant, as Jayadoida Maharaj will know very well, to stay in his immediate company, you had to understand how he spoke English. You had to understand when he did that with his eyebrow, what it meant. And when he did that, exactly what it meant. And when he used a very short, you know, simple instructions that most outsiders wouldn't know what he was talking about. If you didn't know what it meant, you soon found yourself on the outside looking in, simply because he had to have the efficiency of, you know, those things being understood. So perhaps this is a little boastful, but I had to learn that vernacular, if you will. And when I look at this sentence, when I contemplate it, I will sit down. To me it means I will sit and I will engage in an iterative process with the feedback I get as it comes to me. I'll enter with a goal, with a huge reference library and connection to the Supersoul, but still the practical time stance is unique, and I'll apply all those references and connectivities to the problem at hand. We see that all through the history of ISKCON. Adjustments. Pancharatna, I think your computer is getting funny here. I'm going to blame this all on Pancharatna. So, this is just a background for me, why I have continued to think about Varnashram. I also, some of you may know, I spent just about every penny I had in my bank account 25 years ago to purchase a piece of land in South India, 100 acres, which has gone through various permutations and traumas, but it's still there. I still have that. I also purchased a 1,600-acre farm for the Dallas Temple when I was working with His Holiness Tamal Krishna Maharaj. And we had a great dream at that time, which in the time and tides of ISKCON history, it was let go. It was literally 15 feet of river bottom topsoil, 1,600 acres, three streams, a lake, mature pecan trees, an hour and a half from Dallas, Texas. And they, not Tamal, but other GBCs decided to let it go. So this is part of our history of ISKCON. I also negotiated the Three Rivers Farm. I didn't find it. I didn't pay for it, but I was sent into the negotiation. I've been involved a little bit. These were sort of sticking my toe in the water, trying to find a way in. We had many, many months and months of meetings in those days with TKG when he suddenly got this brainstorm. We have to go into Varnashram, right? So Rabi Swami came. A number of other devotees came. They were attracted that time. But it didn't happen. My farm in South India, till date, hasn't happened. But the dream persists. So 4 years ago, I found myself in New York City for various reasons. I was looking for how to restart, how to get involved in something positive. And the last thing I intended was to sit on the streets and bang the cartels and, you know. But I'm trained in the old school. I started out that way. I spent years on the road, on the bus, and ran temples and did that. And devotees kept saying, "Abhi Ram, Ram Roy is out there in Union Square. Don't say that to me. Stop it. Hey, Abhi Ram, why don't you go see it? Ram Roy is out there. Hey." Finally, one day, I found my feet shuffling into Union Square, and there he was, singing his heart out. I thought, oh, you got me. So I sat down 4 years ago. And as you know, we built a Harinam Ashram. And it was actually exactly what I was looking for and what I needed. Because it took me back to the roots of the Jagya, of the Yuga Dharma. We acquired an ashram. Now we've acquired a second ashram. The devotees are joining. Some of you have heard of that. Some of you have been there. Some of you have joined us in Times Square on our Harinams or Union Square. And what started happening is young men and young ladies, primarily men, started joining. And I started working with them, as we as temple leaders must do. All their personal issues. How do they grow as people? What's their future? And very early on, I remember Romapad Swami pulled me into a conference call with, I think, Vaisheshika was on that call, Vaisheshika Prabhu, I think Nityananda Prabhu, a few other devotees, leaders. And there was a discussion about various subjects in the national scope, as Romapad Maharajas want to do. And the question was raised, and somehow it was directed to me at some point, how do we get commitment? How do we inspire commitment? And my answer was, we have to first commit to them. You cannot ask commitment if you're not fully committed to them. You don't have the right. And what does that mean? It was right before my eyes with 25 young men in my ashram, all growing up in Krishna consciousness, also growing up in life at the same time, not knowing what their future would be, and looking to me, essentially, as representing ISKCON, to make them okay, to make it all work out. As a 65-year-old man, I'm starting to understand what that means, what that responsibility is. When I was, you know, a young buck, 25, deciding who everyone would marry and what temple they'd be traded to and what service they'd take on, these things didn't have the same profundity, these type of responsibilities, as they do now. Each one of these devotees that comes is one of God's angels, and they deserve all of my heart. So I realize that most of them will be married someday. Most of them have no life skills. Right? Recently, there's a background to it, which I'll skip, but I was here at Gita Nagari, and one of my sons, one of my young men, came with me. He's here now. His name is Bhakta Lee. I've been sort of spoon-feeding him for 2.5 years. He's like one of my own children. And standing on that porch, he said, "Abhiram, I'm 25 years old. I can play music. I want to have a family. If I turn 30 and that's all I know, I'm going to be very depressed about my life." Right? So here's, wow, a big responsibility he's putting on me. Right? What should I tell him at that point? You pack up. Go to college. Get out of here. I can't do it. Right? That's not what he's expecting. And that's certainly not what Srila Prabhupada is expecting. Srila Prabhupada took that commitment to take responsibility all the way to the last breath and beyond. And if we are to be his representatives, we have to take that responsibility too, or we should not stand in that position. So it occurred very quickly to me that Varnashram was the answer for these boys. And as I started thinking about it, traveling around daydreaming, this is my normal process of manifesting something. I'll have no money, no support, but I'll just start looking at things for sale or looking at things to build or making sketches of buildings. And eventually that will, there's a process where form follows thought, right? And eventually when you articulate your thought sufficiently, it manifests. No one can resist it because form follows thought. So I started wandering around looking at farms, and I was thinking, oh my God, there's going to be World War III, and the zombies are going to be coming, and I think zombies can't swim, so the Delaware River looks like a good boundary, and we'll go over this other side of the Delaware. You know, crazy thoughts like that. Thinking about it more carefully, I mean, I was actually making a joke of it to some of the age, you know, can, you know, they were looking at me. And I was thinking, you know, in reality, if this is what I'm trying to do, to escape the apocalypse, I should go to New Zealand or something. What am I doing in New York State or Pennsylvania? What am I really doing is I'm looking for an extension, an annex, if you will, of the Harinam Ashram, because I'm certainly not going to leave the Harinam Ashram. I'm not going to leave the core Yuga Dharma. And that in itself is the perfection of the Varnashram, that it's supporting, reciprocating back and forth with the Yuga Dharma. Right? That the food we're growing, the children we're breeding on our farm communities and training, some of them, all of them, I hope, for some period of time, will be engaged directly in the preaching in the cities. And then, of course, Srila Prabhupada wanted every city temple to have a farm. So it started shaping like that. I eventually wrote a paper, which is a very crude paper, but Roma Padmaraj was very forgiving, and he read it, and he drilled to the core of what I was trying to say, however crudely I was presented. And he understood, and came with a great deal of enthusiasm and support, which lifted my spirits and made me believe that maybe there's a chance that we can manifest some form of Varnashram that will actually be useful for all temples to copy some parts of. I wanted to set an example. As you see, I don't have a lot of years left, like some of my god brothers. So there's a great deal of urgency to this. So I'm mentioning here that it starts with Harinam. Of course, we all start with Harinam. We start with Prasadam. We start with Kirtan. And in the... what's going on, please? Our system is having fun. I wanted to... these are just a few points of departure. I'm taking a little time on these. But they're fundamental. Even if I don't finish my presentation, I'll be happy that these are presented. I'm not going to rush like I did yesterday to that last slide. I was so encouraged to hear all of the presentations, really. They were really remarkable. But the last presentation we just had from Kanteya was very inspiring to me. I wanted to give you a little more insight into my background. I solidly endorse that our culture will not survive if we do not immediately reinvent the Gurukula. And I have been working on this for some years. As I mentioned, I bought a piece of land 25 years ago, and there's some interesting characteristics about the ownership of that land at the moment. But in any case, it expresses my intent. And this is a school I designed years ago. It's granite, carved in a traditional form. The sacred geometry and the sacred proportions are all honored and respected here. And that picture in the background is a fairly accurate picture of the site that I've chosen, which is in the middle of a jungle, right near Udupi, with where I already have a huge amount of support from some of the senior spiritual leaders in the area, offers of, you know, Sanskrit masters and martial arts teachers from Kerala and all sorts at the top tier. And I have been going to Gurukulas for a number of years, especially in the last couple of years, very intensely. Not ISKCON Gurukulas, traditional Gurukulas. And some of the things I've seen are mind-boggling. I've seen students who are trained in actually gaining mystic powers. My interest is not another Brahminical Gurukula. My interest is to train Kshatriyas and Vaishyas. So we'll take Sudras who want to be Vaishnavas. We'll take Brahmins who also, but our core interest in this particular thought is to train Vaishyas and Kshatriyas. So I've seen a Gurukula that gives me a great deal of inspiration, where 11-year-old boys ride a horse bareback like a Comanche Indian. They don't get up and climb on the horse. They run, kick the back ankle, spring up, fly up on the back of the horse, and yah! And then they stand up on the bareback and they ride it at full run. These are Gurukula boys who chant Sanskrit all morning. And they do their yoga postures hanging on a thick rope, 1.5 stories off the ground. You know how you can tie the rope in different ways and do all the postures. Absolutely fearless. And the same boys that the headmasters come, and I'm sitting there. He says, tell him. So I'm standing there. His eyes are blindfolded, actually. He closes his eyes. His eyes are closed. He starts smelling. He says, in this pocket, right pocket, sao rupia, serial number. And he starts reading the serial number, and I'm pulling out of my pocket. Literally, extrasensory perception. Then the headmaster reads off Sanskrit shlokas. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The boy, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, picks it up just like that. And the headmaster explains to me that in this age, we don't have memory. We don't know what memory is. What you do is you etch into your brain by repetition. That's not memory. Memory is a subtle, almost liquid substance, according to him, that instantly molds around what it experiences and retains it forever. That's memory. So you don't even have it. You don't even have an experience of it. But we see some people, they have what we call photographic memory, right? That was common. That was normal. And he told me, in olden days, a student was tested by giving 100 shlokas that he had never heard before, and he had to immediately recite them all. And if he couldn't, the master knew that there was something, he was Varnasamkara. There was something wrong in the breeding of this boy, right? So he was considered perhaps not fit. So these standards, if we can bring these back, I'm just giving you my background. I formed this trust in India. It's called Bhaktivedanta Rishi Kula Trust, because it's my vision that we need rishis, Renaissance men, in this time of Kali Yuga that know many, many things and are extremely competent, right? So, background. Sorry for a digression, but I just wanted you to understand my thinking. Now I'm in New York City with this background in Prabhupada, with a genuinely, really amazingly supportive GBC, better than I've ever had in my life. And I'm, you know, going back, being in my first TP, I was 1971. I began as a TP. So I've had a long career of being temple president. So, wow, and all kinds of advantages. What to speak of New York City? New York City! I mean, we can, you know, we could sell the t-shirts and the caps. We're NYC Harinam. You know, what a franchise. So, of course, this has been covered to some degree. Srila Prabhupada had this vision of a reciprocity back and forth, farm to city. In the city, what are we harvesting? We're harvesting young men, young women. We're harvesting our future. Right? In the Gurukula, we're breeding our long-term future, our guaranteed success. You know, all of you have worked as a TP, you know, you'll take devotees off the streets. How many will really stick? How many will really go deep? If you get 10 out of 100, you're hitting a it's a very high batting average. But if you train that child from youth in the right way, obviously you're talking in the 80 to 90%. Especially if they're taught as Prabhupada instructed again and again. Ironically, Jagadish published his own critique, thinking it was justification. If you read carefully, Prabhupada kept saying, with love, do this, with love, raise the stick, never use it. That part they conveniently left out. So if we do this maturely, and we must do it, as Kanteya so clearly emphasized, then we have a future. And if we offer the devotees that join us in the city a long-term lifestyle that's sublime and that's prosperous, what's that going to do with our preaching? This is This is the vision that's now forming amongst a conspiracy of us. Vatsal Prabhu and I have a bit of history in the past. We conspired to try to get something started in North Carolina that didn't quite happen the way we envisioned it. Again, Vatsal Prabhu has kindly agreed to be patient with me and put forward his thoughts and energy and offer to participate. So Ramapad Maharaj, Vatsal Prabhu, and myself have been churning this idea to have a farm community within an hour and a half drive of the city. You all know what the city is? Anybody tell me? What's the city? Thank you very much. It's a great big wormy apple. Why New York City? First of all, I sit on the Harinam many days, and I watch people go by, and I'm thinking, that guy would have been working for me 15 years ago. He's walking by. He's giving a thumbs up. He's putting a couple bucks in the basket. Why isn't he stopping? Why doesn't he take us seriously enough? They like us. You know that. You all go out in Harinam. Majority of people like that we're there, passively like it or actively like it. Only some dislike it. Last year I was leading a roaring walking Harinam through up Fifth Avenue, and we came to a cross point at where Broadway cuts across Fifth there. You know, there's all that, there's little islands and there's all that office traffic moving back and forth from the park in front of the, what do you call it, the Flatiron, famous building. And the police now are really nervous when crowds gather because of all the, you know, there's this recently risen religion on the block, which is stirring things up a bit. So they don't like us stopping in places where it could be dangerous, you know. So I came to a little island that was really small, and the crowd just suddenly gathered, and I just couldn't resist, and I stopped, and we just started rocking out, and the people were spilling out over the curb and onto the street, and there's a cop there, and he goes, like this. But I realized this guy was probably a little kid when Harinam was already well established. He was 26, 28 years old, cop. So we have a place. We have street credibility in New York. People do like us. But why don't they join? I'm thinking, why? Remember, because I'm also a person that worked in the world. Everybody in this material world has a mantra playing in their back of their head 24 hours a day, especially during the waking hours. And that mantra is, how do I live? How do I live? How do I live? How do I live? Because they're always threatened with mortality. From the tax collector, the bill collector, the rent collector, the guy at the office who's going to play politics on him, the boss who's a jerk. So many reasons. His own ticker is starting to act funny. Mortality. How do I live? How do I survive? The Hare Krishnas are great, but they don't even offer an answer to that. So how can I take them seriously? And that's why we don't get the core, competent people of America. We get the eccentrics. We get those who are broken. What does it say on the bottom of the Statue of Liberty? Give me your huddled, your mask. What is it? And we get those who are very intelligent and also eccentric. They just can't fit in. But all of them are angels. They're all pious, of course. But what's happening? We're not getting that core competent person who can manage our society, who can spread this movement, and we're painting ourselves into a corner. The few people who are management capable, they're so overburdened with literally teaching the boys how to live, how to drink water. I have to explain, because they don't get these basic lessons. So it's not that we don't want all of these masses. We want them. But we have to get competent people so that we can properly take care of them. And we need an economic system and a social structure. So I believe that if we have a vibrant community in the countryside that's prosperous and the city dwellers are aware of it, it will greatly enhance our preaching. They will take us very seriously. It will change a lot of people's minds. There's an opportunity in New York. New York is a foodie's paradise. The New Yorkers consume monstrous amounts of food, and a lot of that gourmet and organic. And I believe coffee alone, there's something like one ship a day is consumed in New York City of coffee. The whole city is wired on coffee, right? It's common 3 cups a day is the common office goer's dose, right? So, again, I want to offer a viable lifestyle, not just a philosophy. This will be hugely attractive to city dwellers and greatly increase our credibility. Again, as I mentioned, we need to attract the leaders of society who are repeating this mantra, how do I live? We need to demonstrate an attractive model. It's not impossible. So Maya Angelou was the poet laureate of the United States at one time, and she coined this phrase very nicely, not at all foreign to our way of thinking. Making a living is not the same as making a life. And so much evidence is there that people, that employees even, who are offered a higher salary in a dog-eat-dog environment versus a role in a company where they feel as part of that community, they will always opt for the happier environment with others versus the just the money. Of course, now more and more they're being brainwashed that the money will buy you happiness. As with everything that we've experienced with Srila Prabhupada, there is no free model. This phrase, the famous response when one devotee was asking Srila Prabhupada, how do we do this? What's the right way to do this? And Prabhupada said, the right way is the right way that works. Very pragmatic. Very pragmatic. Right? And I was trained that way. I was once asked, a number of times, but one particular case I can recall, I was asked to do something which was impossible to do. It could not be done. And I resorted to blackmailing a CIA officer. Literally, that's what I did. Balavanta was at my side, and he said, I can't believe you just did that. And he's threatening to kill you. I said, well, Prabhupada wanted it done. And he did it. He capitulated. And when I came back with that result and gave it to Prabhupada, he literally applauded. He expected us to do what was difficult to do, and even what was impossible to do. And however we had to do it, we had to get it done. So I think I mentioned in the earlier presentation, but very quickly, that I believe that the primary problem with starting Varnashram is we don't see how to do it. And part of what's stumping us are what I call the fundamentalists, the self-sufficiency fundamentalists, the SSFs, who want us to hark back to the 17th century or the 18th century, which we can't imagine how to do that. Okay, I'm going to try that now. I'm going to go try that. First of all, I go out and I find some land. And he says, well, it's $10,000 an acre. And that's, you know, a couple hours from the city, not from any major city. You'll pay that. I was just told by some devotees, even Chicago, even Detroit. Even Detroit! What happened? When I was a young man, you could buy any farmland in America for $150 to $100 an acre. Anywhere. And the old timers out there on the farm were chewing on the straw and thinking we were a bunch of idiots coming from the city being all excited about $50 an acre farmland. I said, my God, these boys are idiots. So what happened is capitalism moved in. And it brought in the inheritance tax. I mentioned that. So the family farm was broken. Then Big Agro came in and started buying it up. Big Agro is financed by Big Bank. And Big Bank doesn't earn their money. They steal their money. They create their money. So they're not suffering for that money like we have to. So we've been pushed off the land. But in 17th century, 18th century, people didn't pay for land. Think about that. Nobody paid for land, ever. No farmer paid for land. He got it from his feudal lord. He got it from his raja or his village leader or his father. Or at best, he came to America, bought a few bullets and killed the natives, took the land. People didn't buy land. And they still don't in India. You see a village, you see village houses. If you take your American brain and ask, how much would it cost to buy one of these little... What? He doesn't have a title. He never bought it. It's not owned officially. He just built his house. It's an entirely different context. To say go out now and live in the 17th century, you might as well tell someone, go swim in that swimming pool. By the way, it doesn't have any water, but go swim anyway. The context is gone. It's changed. We have to deal with the times that are with us now. And instinctively, many devotees, they process that. There's a certain, you know, a logarithm that everyone has in their subconscious. When they hear an idea, they do an instant take. Is it possible? And in imagining this self-sufficient model that people describe, instantly, no, can't be done. I don't know how to do it anyway. Which was, we were quoting Anuttama's illusion. Not because he wasn't ready to do austerity. He's been doing austerity his whole life. Not because he wasn't willing to work hard for profit. He's been working hard his whole life. These are preposterous, and I've heard these suggestions. Oh, they're not sincere. That's ridiculous. Of course they're sincere. You just need to see how to do it. So, we have to drill down to the principles and find that genius core of how to do it. Varnashram manifested in so many different ways. I've been studying, as I mentioned yesterday, especially from a person whose name is Ravindra Sharma, and he has an ashram called Kala Ashram. Varieties of intellectuals in India go to visit him. He's made a study of old village life, and he's been documenting it. Right? And he lives it himself. He's lived it his whole life, although he's a great intellectual. And I've known some of the scholars that, you know, I spent some years in India, and I've known some of the scholars who worked with him. And basically, it's just detailing exactly what Prabhupada has already described in principle. And what I've seen is, and traveling around India, I used to go with one of my friends who was a college professor on what's called a GUM, where you just go. You don't know where you're going. You just go. We're just going to discover India. Let's go. We go out to villages, and when we're hungry, we sit down at a hut, and we say, can we, and they get all excited and start cooking and feed us, and then we move on. Just to observe India, just catch it off guard, sort of, try to understand what it was, what it is. And what we see is there are unlimited models. I mentioned yesterday, there were Sudra villages with Sudra kings. There were Brahmin villages, still are today. The village in South India where they only speak Sanskrit. They only speak to each other in Sanskrit. So there are all kinds of variations. Principles, but unlimited variations. And so we will have to have unique variations for America. Therefore I titled my paper, the beginning of this paper yesterday was, American Vedic. You remember that picture, I was meaning to put it up. The famous American Gothic picture of the two farmers, husband and wife, standing with a pitchfork in the middle. American Gothic. American Vedic. This is what we have to discover. How do we do it in America? How do we do it in North America? I'm in New York City. We're standing in snow up to our knees a few months of the year. How do you do that? How do you eat? We're vegetarians, after all. People that lived in the North, they hunted. They supplemented or they stored. Right? How do we do this? Well, there are ways to do it, and there are people doing it. The good news is that we don't have to invent the wheel. It's all being done. There are plenty of vegetarians living in Vermont, in Maine, growing their own food. In New York, in the Hudson Valley, growing their own food. And selling their food. And making a handsome living. You're all aware of that, I'm sure. So it's really just a matter of being willing to be creative and putting the pieces together. The pieces are already there. So we started a couple of years ago a food business. I had in my business career done some consulting for a very large food company in India. It's the largest organic food support organization in the world. We had 50,000 certified organic, internationally organically certified farmers, and we had 50,000 in the pipeline that were being certified. Today they're probably up to 150,000. And they were producing mountains of organic food, and they wanted to go retail because they wanted to create a market where the farmers could get more money for their additional effort. So I created the retail chain. That was my little consulting role. And I had a little look into the food business at that time. So kind of having that in my blood and having a little business in my background and the Hari Nam Ashram, you know, always coming up short in terms of monthly obligations, we started a bakery, which you, I hope if you all got cookies and things at the breakfast, you have a little introduction. And Bhakti John, who's the manager of our bakery, will mention a few things at the end of my presentation. It's an anecdote. It's an example of how I see Varnashram beginning today in this situation. Is devotees starting businesses, householders starting business, as Prabhupada mentioned in the earlier presentation, it was noted, prosperous businesses based on food, and ideally drawing that food out of our land. So we've already visualized a farm-to-table soup business once we get our farm, if we get our farm, right, where we would be growing the beets and the carrots and the celery and producing the soup and creating a product that was fresh and delivered in the city. We're already bringing in a devotee, Roma Padmaraj, and Danista Mata introduced me to a Hector who's farming and living off the land. He's chanting japa and he's living in our target area in the Hudson Valley, and for 14 years he's been living that way. And before that 5 years he apprenticed with the Amish and knows very well how to live off the land. Again, we're not reinventing the wheel. People are doing it. And this is not a torture. It's not like, you know, the fingernail screw or, you know, the Iron Maiden or something. This is not some kind of medieval torture. This is a sublime lifestyle we're talking about. What is so hard about it? Right? So, with New York City gobbling up as much organic food. There was a lady in upstate New York we ran into looking for land. She started out 20-some years ago with 40 acres leased. And she got an exclusive contract in those days with Whole Foods to supply them with organic vegetables. Today she owns 800 acres in the Hudson Valley. Each one of those acres is worth $10,000 probably, $8,000 to $10,000 at minimum. And she's looking for more land. She's like a terror in that area. I chose not to look for land in there because you better watch out. She's just going to buy up anything that's good. You know? Move on. So this is a new opportunity. It's coming up. Is wholesome, healthy foods, right? Yes, big agro has taken over and dominated the commodity food world. Don't go into competition with them. That's silly because, like I said, they don't pay with sweat and blood for their money. They're subsidized. In every way, the game is tilted towards them. There's no way you're going to win. It's predetermined. But the beautiful thing about the health market is that it depends upon mom and pops in their kitchen inventing new foods. And then when it kicks in and eventually succeeds, then big food comes in and buys them up, right? Hopefully. At least that's the hope of the capitalists. Therefore, they let it go on because they themselves don't know how to incubate those kind of creative ideas. They know they lack that creativity. So it's a perfect opportunity for small entrepreneurs to begin. We must live off the land. But in the present circumstances, we can't make our own shoes, unlikely that we're going to weave our own cloth, so many other things that are required to make this transition in time, in a natural way. How far will we go? I don't know. Will we ever really? I mean, what I asked yesterday, what is self-sufficiency? What does it mean? Does it mean you will come to the Yukon, you know, coon hat and start hatcheting your logs? Or do you have suddenly have a wife with you? Are you self-sufficient? Or you're, okay, you got a little community starting. Then you have kids. And then you meet another eccentric living, you know, over the other hill. And you start cooperating together. Now suddenly there's community growing. So where does it end? And that is not our goal. Our goal is not just to say that we're totally on our own. Our goal is to reduce the connection to technology. I think the Amish presentation was so relevant that Deva Amrita Swami gave in the beginning. Their idea of technology is not fanatic. They have batteries. They have various things when they're needed. But they very carefully discuss how far do we have to go? What's practical to support our lifestyle? And at what point does it become oppressive to our lifestyle? So we must live off the land, and for that, today we need money. Growing and selling food products do two things. They get us growing. They get us growing. They get our feet in the dirt, our hands in the dirt. And they get us learning. We have to learn. Srila Prabhupada, remember, sit down, the iterative process, getting feedback, figuring it out, and teach you. Again, teach. We have to learn and we have to teach how to live off the land, how to grow, and while we're earning, that creates a very comfortable transitional process. So I very strongly advocate this is not a return to an 18th century type of self-sufficiency. And even if you want to argue 18th century self-sufficiency, where? Are you talking about the American tier? The tattered remains of feudal Europe? You're talking about India, just at the beginning of the rise of the British Raj? What are you talking about? There's so many different versions and so many different eras of Vedic culture that practically it is... a constantly moving and morphing format. So what is common is that it adapts to reality. Otherwise, people won't live. This is something you learn in business. In philosophy, you don't get to learn this. You might be intelligent and pick it up, but you don't have to learn it in philosophy. You can think any crazy thought you want. You can argue it. You can write a whole philosophy about it. Rousseau did that. Right? Rousseau said, immediately everyone should, all the brown people of the world should rise up and kill all the white people. That was Rousseau. Immediately you should kill everyone who has a memory, and we should return to year zero. That was Rousseau. Paul Pot was a disciple. He studied at the University of Paris, at the Sorbonne. He was a disciple of Rousseau. As a philosopher, you're not obligated to think something that works. You can just say any damn thing. But when you're in business, or when you're out there trying to live, you can say any damn thing, but you're going to starve. Because reality is not going to be impressed. It's going to come back and knock you down. So it's a fabulous way of learning to get out there and actually interact in realistic ways. And the 18th century, it remains in the 18th century. We have to live with times that are with thee, and then progress we will call. So a big part of contemporary food business is marketing. And this provides opportunities for devotees who have certain types of skills, another type of skill set. Some devotees just look forward. I've got young men in ashrams at house. They're the nicest people I know. And others tell me, well, you know, I can do marketing. I can think that way. You know, it makes sense to me. So this is required. There's all types of marketing. We'll again show our website, our long-awaited website, at the end of this very quickly. And already you know the farmers markets are there. In New York City, we have an organization sponsored by the city. It's called NY Green. And that's the official farmers market organization. They have 54 full-time farmers markets, 54, in New York City, not New York State, New York City. Outside of that, various other organizations, churches and, you know, communities, little community organizations, they also have another 83 farmers markets that are more sporadic. So we're talking about a lot of farmers markets. Right? In New York City alone. It is part of New York life now. On Wednesday afternoon or Saturday, you get your little recyclable bag and you stroll around in the parks and look at the farmers' offerings. I'm sure all of your cities have similar offerings. But New York City, that's a big city, and they eat a lot of organic food. So this is a great place for interacting, and if we're there as Krishna's pure foods, we're there as the Hare Krishnas, right? And we're already known for quality food. I was, one of my kids made me watch a movie the other day. Of course, I didn't fight too much, but it was a classical cop and robber and shoot 'em up movie. And the tough guy, the tough cop, was a expert. I mean, he was a cliche himself. He was like, nothing but cliches and cliches upon cliches, and he himself was a cliche. Anyway, he walked into someone's apartment and the fellow was eating a vegetarian meal, and he went and looked over at him. He says, "What is that, Hare Krishna food?" So we've become a cliche in food, vegetarian food. We are starting to own that space. From a marketing point of view, that's exciting. People think that maybe we're a little nutty, but we're serious. They gotta be sincere. They wouldn't be doing that if they weren't. And that translates in the image of our food. And that's a marketing angle if you're in business, right? So as with our Krishna's Bakery, Bhakta John sitting here is the head of it, he's not finding we're selling our cookies in Muslim-owned coffee chains where the owners are fanatic Muslims, beards and everything. They're selling Krishna's cookies. There's no resistance. We've never had anyone go, "Oh, Krishna's cookies." It doesn't happen. People go, "Oh, yeah, Krishna. Hey, cool. Okay. I had their food. Steve Jobs used to eat their food." So I suggest that we consider Srila Prabhupada's prediction that millions will come to our farms. Millions. We don't get millions in our temples. There's a limited scope for people to live in the way that devotees live in temples and ashrams. There's a very limited scope. Even amongst those devotees who are currently in the temples and ashrams, very few of them can imagine doing that forever. And some of those very few, or some of those many, I should say, that can't imagine forever, the advanced devotees also. And they themselves can't imagine that I'll live this way forever. So, we need these communities. We need a broader space so that this house that was predicted, that, you know, the house that the whole world could live in, can actually manifest. And I believe when we start establishing viable and prosperous communities, and we don't have them now, I don't mean to be rude, but we don't have them in America. We don't have viable and prosperous communities. We have some properties that look like farms. even grow a few things. But they're not dynamic, prosperous communities. They're not Varnashram communities, right? As Srila Prabhupada envisioned. And they can't accommodate thousands of people. If you ask the leaders in any one of these farms, can you, if we bring 2,000 people, can you accommodate? Absolutely stunned. They have no idea. They have no answer whatsoever. We have to find those answers. We have to. Because this movement is meant to grow. That is our mandate. And Varnashram is, Prabhupada said, 50%. It wasn't like the also ran horse, you know, that we knew wasn't going to win. It's 50% of the 100%. It's not, oh yeah, that other project. No, it's the same project. Otherwise he wouldn't have said 50%. He would have said, oh yeah, that other project. I had another one in mind. And why it's the 50%? It finishes it up. It gives us a place to take all those interested souls and let them live a sublime life in security and prosperity and genuine happiness, as much as happiness can be achieved in this world. You achieve that in the countryside. You don't achieve that in the city. Everyone knows that. Right? Once we establish Varnashram in America, therefore I've called my paper American Vedic, we will have thousands and thousands and thousands of devotees joining every year. Every year. Today, if you take a poll, how many devotees are joining in North America? Hundreds, 100, 200, 300, I don't know. Of course, it's a little difficult because not all devotees move into the temples nowadays. And they're still excellent devotees. They're real, genuine devotees. But it's, you know what it is. It's not gigantic. Once we have a lifestyle, once we have a viable, prosperous lifestyle, we will see Prabhupada's prediction come true. Every one of Prabhupada's predictions comes true. He cannot be wrong. He's never been wrong. Okay, well, I think this has been already covered in different ways. Prabhupada didn't come to America and say, I want you to all pack up, we're going to go to Vrindavan and we're going to live under a different tree every night. Nor do any of the yoga process, you know, there's yama, niyama, asana, pranayama. There's steps, there's processes. All human change requires steps. When the British were shifting from a feudal system to a more so-called democratic system, where the lords were being disempowered, British are very intelligent people. Instead of just saying, okay, we're taking away your power, no, they didn't do that. They said, all right, Lord Postmaster General, who doesn't even know how to lick a stamp, but gets a regular income from all the postage that's going on in this UK, you're going to continue till your death, and your son will get half, and his son will be finished by then. Yeah, okay. Gradual, right? When you turn a battleship, it doesn't turn like a sports car. It takes time. But once it's turned, it's also difficult to stop it. So human change is in step by step. Our process is step by step. What we're proposing is to begin with viable businesses. This is not a compromise. I'm not doing this because I love business. May I tell you, I loathe business. I did business, but I hate it. I would prefer to be sitting and writing and learning from advanced sadhus. I really way over it. But I believe that this must manifest. Prabhupada's vision must manifest. And I sincerely believe that this is the way. That this is a practical way that will actually happen. Srila Prabhupada used to quote a Bengali poem. I don't know if you know the Bengali, but big monkey. Perhaps you've heard it. He translated it once for me when I was TP in Calcutta. Huh? Okay. It means big monkey. Bora bora. Big monkey. Big belly. Lanka jumping. Melancholy. What it means is, we're like the big monkeys. We come, yeah, I can do it. We got a big belly too. We're eating away. I can do it. We go, we're going to jump to Lanka. And then we don't make it. And we become melancholy. This was his, he would joke with us sometimes that we were like that at times. So, I don't want to take on Varnashram in that way. I want it to happen. I don't want to do business. I want Varnashram to happen. And this is how it will practically happen. You, devotees, who are now working in the city, and devotees like you, can seriously contemplate this kind of transition. You can consider that kind of transition. Otherwise, you'll carry on the way you are, and you won't enjoy the full support of Varnashram, and the movement won't get your wisdom and your enthusiasm in as much of magnitude as we could. New York City is also a participant, just as Mother Earth, Mother Cow, they're already there, welcoming us, inviting us into their community. It's actually us joining their community that we will be doing and hope for. But New York City is also a participant. The Big Apple was very, very magnanimous to Srila Prabhupada. I remember when we were waiting for Prabhupada's I had gotten Prabhupada's passport and his visa to go, and that was part of that story where I had to threaten a CIA agent with exposing him in India at that time, that I knew he was a CIA agent. And that's when he capitulated and agreed to get the stamp for Prabhupada, because Prabhupada had already been rejected by the head of visa department in all of India. And once that rejection, you know what that means. You're finished. There's no way. The President of the United States can't trump that. Only the CIA can do that. They're the only ones that have more power than the President of the United States. And he did it. So, but still there was some tension, some anxiety. They thought, well, you know, we kind of got it under dicey ways. Maybe when Prabhupada gets to the border, they could turn him back, right? And that would be devastating for Prabhupada's health. He could barely make the flight. So we were waiting for Balavanta Prabhu to work with his political contacts and get an assurance that Prabhupada would be welcomed into the States. When I was massaging Prabhupada in his bedroom in the London Manor, Tamal suddenly burst in, said, Srila Prabhupada, we were waiting for this news. America is ready to greet you. Prabhupada started crying. He burst out. He said, America, America. You've given me everything, men, money, everything. I am so much grateful. I can never forget. New York City gave Prabhupada his first footing, gave him everything. Right? As wild and crazy it is, the universe kind of works that way. There's these like ironic opposites that occur, you know, places. Right? New York City is like that. You'll never find a better place for Harinam. Everyone who's been there knows it's Harinam heaven. It's heaven for preaching. There's so many spots. Ramapad Maharshi used to be Sankirtan leader for so many years. He was going over some of the spots that they used to use. And we've never been there. Just there's so many spots. It's a wonderful place. And I believe that it's the spot to springboard into Varnashram. Ironically, where else? I mean, who would have thought that? That wasn't my thought process. I ended up there by happenstance. My thought was, oh, let's go to Mexico and buy a big piece. Let's go to South India. Let's go somewhere, you know, wonderful. Not New York City. But now I'm finding, wow, there's all kinds of food prosperity in the Hudson Valley, in the surrounding areas. There's all kinds of people making a living, growing food with their hands and going to the city and selling it. They're living a nice life. They're in the country. This is a foundation that's just waiting for us to exploit. Just like so many people come to the Big Apple and take a bite. So this is our concept. These are all self-evident points. In the Hudson City Council of New York is presently pushing a bill through to, and this is regular, they do this all the time, to give another $50 million to preserve farmland in the Hudson Valley because they consider it their backyard, their back garden. They treasure it. They value it. Governor Cuomo just gave $20 million to the same fund. And, you know, you know what preservation is. They'll go to a farmer and they'll say, look, if you will legally put this land forever and ever and ever into agriculture, no one can ever build on it, we'll give you $500,000. We'll give you $1 million. The farm says, yeah, okay, I'm only going to farm. He takes the money. It's put on the title. It can never, ever be developed. So this is a prosperous and treasured farming region that intimately connects with New York City. Weddings, thousands and thousands of weddings are held up there. This is where, if you, as I have many times looking for land, if you are so silly just to try to exit New York City into the Hudson Valley on a Friday afternoon, you will sit in traffic for 2 hours before you cross the George Washington Bridge. Many times. There's so many people going up there. It's a little bed and breakfast and, you know, that whole region. It's intimately connected with New York City and people are aware of what is going on there. All right, the Hudson Valley is basically a Norman Rockwell painting. Very beautiful. Wonderful farmland. This is a quote from a group called the Hudson Valley Hub. It was founded by Warren Buffett's son, Peter. And they have several thousand acres, and they're teaching sustainable farming. They're keeping, a seed bank and working in the whole area to encourage sustainable farming. It's a big trend here. It's like Vermont in a sense, where there's just a lot of back to the land people and very strong farming ethics. So our goal is to produce food for sale and internal consumption. I mean, that I hope is a given. You understand that when you're producing, you know, thousands of dollars a week worth of food. Just our one man, Hector, he averages $2,000 a week at the farmer's market for himself and selling, right? When you're producing thousands of dollars worth of food, you know, you're talking about 5 or 10% of that production for feeding your community and your temples, right, in the city. But that circle of income encourages the expansion of the agriculture. The city of Paris in the 1800s had a famous culture of what's called market gardeners. They were totally self-sufficient within the boundaries of the city limits on all vegetables and all fruit, and they exported to London. The average farmer had 1 acre, and he would harvest his crop 8 to 10 times a year. That means they would have a lettuce ready for harvest, almost ready. They would have their leeks, they have these spears that grow, spearing through that lettuce. They would have 2 other crops at different stages of sprouting, all at the same time. And they would come in carefully and cut the lettuce. And then 3 weeks later, the leeks come out. 3 weeks later, like that. Right? Intensely. So it also doesn't take huge amounts of land. Tukaram Prabhu and myself had some discussions on cow fodder. And it's all in that same direction, that we may be in situations where we have small pieces of land, but there are very rational technologies available to respond to that. They don't require, you know, space-age gizmos. There's just simply a way of managing. Obviously, we're in a climate where growing, as we commonly think of it, is difficult in the snow, but again, technology, greenhouses. There are many farms that grow all year round. Our friend Hector grows all year round. He goes to the farmer's market all year round. There are plenty of farms that do this. It's just a matter of learning the processes. Not rocket science. We're not landing a man on the moon. We're doing what human beings have been doing since the beginning of time. We're growing food. Woodlands, even the woodlands, you can grow ginseng, golden seal, medicinal mushrooms, even your woodlands. Plus you get the wood chips out of it for your mulching, which is, that's another magic we'll talk about some other day. Certainly not the least, Mother Cow is the alchemist. I coined this phrase as this is how I see Mother Cow. She's the greatest blessing from the Lord. It is not some poetic, artistic decoration that Krishna has cows. This is a core part of Krishna's heart. He has cows. He's a cowherd. If you go through the 1,000 names of Krishna, how many of them refer to him as a cowherd? Big percentage, more than 10%, my last count. The very important part of his personality. The cow isn't just another animal that happens to give nice milk. The cow was a gift from the gods to the humans so that we could translate the products of Mother Earth into the finest food. There's no food that's more nourishing because the ghee, proper ghee, that I should say cultured ghee, not the ghee you buy in the store today. That's not ghee, that's butterfat. You don't buy ghee. It's not available. Not Indian ghee, and it's all butterfat. To yogurt, as Prabhupada said, right? And those of you who went to Gurukul, remember the little rhyme? You turn it into yogurt. Okay. That's essential because the bacteria in the yogurt digest the fat molecule and actually reduce it so it can actually penetrate into the ojas, into the spinal fluid. The full butterfat molecule can't do that. It's butter, it's okay. It's not terrible, it's butter. It's nice. But it's not ghee. So there's magic in this cow. There's magic in her. When Srila Prabhupada was sick, he asked us to get a black cow and tie her up at the front door for her sympathy. Do you know what it's said in India? That when a cow licks your hand, she can remove your karma. She's such a mother. She feels your pains. She feels your illness. And she actually tries to take it in. It's her nature. They say that your fate line will change when a cow is licking your hand. This is maybe superstition, but it's based on something. It's based on their understanding of the nature of mother. Mother. She embraces us. She loves us. You see her standing there in Delhi traffic. The cars are screaming by, bang, bang, all kinds of danger. And she's just standing, doing her dharma, right? Ready to serve, ready to love us. You know how dogs can love? Dogs can love. Cows have far more capacity to love. When you have that experience of working with a cow, I've seen in my dear friend Prem Kishore's little cow herd in Vrindavan, he's a little group of cows, and he takes care of those cows better than I've ever seen children taken care of, really. When he milks Yamuna and he literally gets down and sprays it in his mouth, I've seen her tear, and she nudges him and licks him like just like she licks the calves. Right? All of you are dealing with cows. You'll learn this, of course. The Western cow has been living in fear for generations. In their epigenetics, you know, that fear is encoded. They know we're danger. When I was a little boy, my father brought home a German Shepherd puppy, still, you know, hairless, that young. And I grew up with that dog. And I was a terror as a little boy, probably worse now. But I used to tease him mercilessly. And one of the things I loved to do was pretend I was going to shoot with a gun, like little boys do. And he would immediately, he saw that, just that. Where did he have that? He never saw a gun. He was never shot. It's in the epigenetics. So the Western cow is not accustomed to us as being their friend. They're afraid of us. Might be one of the reasons why the Western bull is so aggressive, so eager to kill you. They don't see us as friend. But an Indian cow, it's a different experience. Of course, now they're being trained differently. Now all the Indian cows are being slaughtered. One Italian lady did what 1,000 years of Mughal and British rule could not do, almost destroyed India completely. One Italian lady. I have 15 minutes, right? Thank you. Okay. Milk softens the heart. When you eat the food of someone who's divine, who loves, you imagine what it would be like to eat food cooked by Srila Prabhupada? Some of us ate food cooked by a sister, Pishima, right? Many of us have eaten food cooked by very loving and divine devotees. There's an impact. You feel that. It changes you. That love goes into your body. It becomes part of your being. When you're taking care of the cow and she feels that you're her calf, you're her calf. She loves you. That nanonutrient goes into her milk. That magic goes into her milk. And that softens your heart. That's the secret of cow milk. It's not the proteins and all that. That's there. This is the real secret. We can get proteins from so many other places. We can simulate them in so many other ways. It's that love. You can't duplicate that. She has that motherly spirit. And if you want to develop love of Krishna, you'll notice the vegans, Buddhists, Mayavads, I deeply respect the point that we should avoid cow milk from slaughtered milk, but Prabhupada didn't do that. And he knew. It's not that Prabhupada was naive. He knew what was going on. But he knew more than we knew. He knew how important milk as a substance is to human, to being human. If you weren't breastfed by your own mother, you had a significant advantage as a human being. There's so many ramifications to that. And mother cow, similarly, we're supposed to have the mother in our life. I think both points should go together. Yes, we should not want to drink a drop of milk from blood milk, but we should immediately want to have milk. I also don't drink milk in America. Main reason is I can't take A1 milk. I immediately get mucus, because the Western hybrid cow produces a type of protein in the casein that's not similar to human milk, which is what the vegans claim, and they're right. It's true. The Holstein cow, which is 90% of all dairy milk from the Holstein cow, your human body can't actually properly digest it. When I get to India, when I get to Giranagari, the Brown Swiss cows, by the way, are 65% A2. They're quite good. When I get to India, I can drink gallons and gallons of milk and just all digest, perfectly digest. Right? So I also, I used to be a purist of cows. You should never sell the milk, all these sort of things. I came to Giranagari and I looked at what they were doing with my normal, usual critical mood. And I was converted. I realized that this is probably required in the West. We have to breed cows. We have to become cowmen. And we'll have to sell cow products. That's practical. And Prabhupada was practical. And Prabhupada did mention the sell the ghee. He mentioned it, right? So, I told you that Tukaram and I had had conversations. I've had conversations with other devotees. There are methods of feeding cows. We don't need thousands of acres of open pasture, open forest. There are intense methods of growing fodder, which are very practical. They're being used all over the world now, even in India, where just like when you sprout grains, when you sprout your mung beans or something, you sprout the cow's feed and it multiplies the nutrition and the bulk and the health many, many fold. That's being done everywhere. It's most commercial dairies are now going to this. Very practical, very simple. You just sprout grains. So these are the kind of things we have to learn. And then we have to teach it. I envision our farm as being, from my point of view, is primarily a school. It's a varnashram college. It's teaching practical life skills. And probably half of the worker bees will be apprentices who will be earning their keep and earning their school tuition by working on the farm and having some theory classes at the same time so they understand what they're doing and how it all fits into the big picture, right? But hands-on. Farming is something that's learned hands-on, right? So who will do the work? You offer a prosperous livelihood with a genuine future and a lifestyle in a community. I'm convinced that the volunteers will be unlimited. Already, just me talking about it around New York City, we're already full. I mean, in theory, we're already full. We already have enough students. We already have enough people that are ready to live this lifestyle. And I think our farms will grow unlimitedly. But we have to teach. We have to teach these life skills, and we have to show them how to be prosperous. So we as leaders have to learn how to do that. We have to sit down, and we have to learn it, and then we have to teach it, how to live off the land. At the same time, that builds, as I mentioned earlier, genuine food production competency. The curriculum is already abundantly available. We don't have to grow up advanced gurus. There are so many farming gurus, so many food production gurus. We just have to bring them in, pick and choose. Get Dr. John's program going. Now, this will make Roma Plod Marsh very happy. 7 minutes before, I'm coming to the summary. This is the 100%, the 50%, and the 50%. Sustainable community, joyful and practical philosophy. So Bhakti John is going to set up, and can I take any comments from my esteemed audience or questions? Right there.
Hey, Krishna. I just wanted a quick question about, ask a quick question about the concept that people see farming as harder work than, I don't know, going to a regular 9-to-5 day job, and that people may not relate on a practical level that, is it necessarily
harder work? It's a strange perspective when you really think about it deeply. A guy sits in an office all day, and he says, it's hard work to farm. And then what does he do in the afternoon? Do you know what he does when he gets off work? He goes to the gym. That's hard work. It's a mental adjustment. It's not hard work. And especially modern intensive farming methods, it's not grunt work. It's more brain work. Yes, you're moving around. You're adjusting things all day. It's not hard work, no. And there are people that enjoy hard work, and that's a certain type of nature. Right? And there are others who have more intelligence, and they enjoy, you know, measuring the pH and looking at crops and how they're coming and the weather cycles, and using their brain more, right? And others that think about marketing and how do we turn this into something. You know, there are various types of work.
How do we show that perhaps it'd be easier work?
Well, I think that's why I want to demonstrate it. You know, I was even reluctant to speak at this conference because I don't know that I really have a right to speak. I haven't done anything. So I'm very eager to do something and show. I don't know. I've kept a garden most of my life since I was knee-high to a grasshopper, as they say on the farm. And I've produced regularly in my gardens more than, you know, I could consume, more than my family could. I mean, I remember my kids saying, oh, no, not spinach again. Can't you give it to the neighbors? So once you start gardening, you see it's not really that hard. Grains is a bigger issue. Milk, we see how milk is done. It's not physically that hard. And it's a wonderful way to adjust your body, to live and then moving around and be outside. You know? Ma.
Who has the hand?
She's in the back there.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Just to share that some devotees from UAE, Dubai, is the brother of the temple president over there. He left work and he went blindly in Salem under the direction of Bhakti Vikas Maharaj. Now they have three projects, and this project is called Panchavati, and they are 80% self-sufficient now. So I was thinking maybe you can go and get more information. 80%.
We similarly have this land in South India, which I've mentioned I've been involved with. We everything we eat there now, we grow on the land, our rice, all our vegetables, all our fruits. And it involves some what you might call sudra labor. We hire some local people, but mostly the devotees do all the primary work. They do all the cow work. It's not terribly difficult, it really isn't. I mean, it's a different lifestyle. If you're living in the city, going out, you know, for a weekend and working on the farm, you might feel, oh, there's a little bit of physical exertion here. But once you're in that cycle, it's not a big deal. It's not that difficult. Maharaj. As soon as he's ready, it's going to come on. Are you ready?
We have one more question. I suggest that he can he can do when you do your breakout session or something.
We'll have another session.
Thank you, Prabhu, for a wonderful presentation. To me, ISKCON as an organization, an institution, we call many names, has been offering a spiritual training, devotee care, social support. I see lack of medical support. Do you include this in your plan? How you going to add into it? Or we have to rely externally all the time?
Well, I'm trying to start something. This has a long way to grow. I'm just one small person trying to make a start that will sustain and that will give us a springboard to go forward. There are so many other things that need to be developed as the community expands. One thing I will mention is that you'll have less need for medical. Modern cities and modern so-called people are very happy to boast about, look at all the hospitals we have. You could look at that on the other side. Why do you need so many hospitals? It's not like people were primitive 50 years ago or 100 years ago. They took care of their needs. Are you ready, Ashok? It's on? It's not on.
So thank you very much. Please thank Abhiram Prabhu.